Welcome to thejournal.ie's The Explainer, where every week we take a deep dive into a different news story. I'm Laura Byrne, and this week, what is the CAS review and what does it tell us about trans services in the UK and Ireland? Well, trans people and services for trans people have become what political commentators would call a wedge issue, a topic which divides the room in a different way than we would usually see. Strong views can lure voters from one party or candidate to another. These issues usually come with some level of toxicity. Recently, there have been three broad areas of discussion on this matter. One, the culture war around the concept of gender. Two, the medical aspect of transitioning, particularly in relation to children. And three, what happened at Tavistock. So today we are just examining the CAS review and trans healthcare. Tavistock is how England's Gender Identity Development Service was known, and problems emerged after whistleblowers began to speak up about their concerns. Now, the service itself was absolutely stretched. Long waiting lists meant that many of its patients were arriving with acute levels of distress after years of not being seen by specialist medical teams. That was 6 years ago, and since then, Dr. Hilary Cass was asked to undertake a full review of the UK's gender services. Now, this impacts Ireland hugely, as we were referring children to Tavistock, and we're trying to figure out our own best practice healthcare for trans kids and adults. Dr. Cass reported her findings last week, which have been all over the news and column pages ever since. Now, people on both sides of this so-called wedge issue have discussed and fought over the Cass review. But what exactly does Cass say, and what can we learn from this report? And what have we found out about the Irish children who were being treated there? Today, I'm joined by our own reporter, Valerie Flynn, who's been across the story for us. Now, before we start, just a note for our listeners from us here at The Explainer. We've taken as much care as we possibly could with this episode, including with our language, as we are extremely aware that it is vulnerable children at the heart of this healthcare story. Valerie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Laura.
Valerie, when we talk about gender dysphoria, what are we referring to?
Gender dysphoria is a medical term that describes a feeling. It's a feeling of unease or discomfort or distress a person might experience because of a mismatch between their biological sex, their birth sex, and their gender identity, so the gender that they feel themselves to really be. And of course, then when it comes to gender identity, some people don't feel that they are male or female, so they might identify as non-binary. That's actually the fastest growing group within the wider trans group. So then the CAS review examined the causes of this dysphoria, with a particular eye to why so many kids presenting for gender treatment now are actually births registered females who present with dysphoria in adolescence. And the fact that that's by far the biggest group is something that has changed a lot in the space of just a few years. So CAS concluded that there was kind of broad agreement that gender incongruence or dysphoria is like so many other human characteristics, because it's just really complex. It arises from a whole combination of biological factors, psychological factors, social, cultural factors. So a whole mix of things at play, including biological predisposition, early childhood experiences, sexuality, you know, children's expectations of puberty. And then for any given individual, a whole different mix of these and other factors will apply. But the upshot is that people with gender dysphoria can feel really strongly that they need to live in a way that matches their gender identity. So the way they look and the way they behave is likely to reflect that. That's what's known as social transition. And then some people may want to use hormones and sometimes surgery to express their gender identity. That's medical transition. But the CAS review was really clear that a diagnosis of gender dysphoria in childhood is not predictive in a reliable way of whether that young person will have long-standing gender incongruence in the future, or of whether medical intervention is going to be the best option for them.
So a really complex issue, as you outlined there. Now, puberty blockers, Valerie, are going to form a big part of this conversation. What are they? What is their history and how are they used?
Well, they're medicines and they're designed to pause the physical changes that come with puberty. For example, growing facial hair. The history is that they were originally developed in the 80s to treat very early onset puberty, like in small kids before the age of 8. But then in the late 90s and the early 2000s, they were used in a different way. And they're first used in the Netherlands to delay the normal onset of puberty in trans kids. So why do they do that? Well, the rationale was kind of threefold. First, the idea is to like buy a young person with gender dysphoria some time, like some time to think and to explore their gender identity, to think about whether they want or need to medically transition, for example, by going on to take testosterone hormone. The second rationale was that they could find it easier to kind of pass as their chosen identity later in life if they hadn't gone through puberty with all the changes that that brings, like, you know, developing an Adam's apple, for example. And then the third rationale, which kind of came a bit later, was that there could be improved body image and improved psychological well-being for young trans kids who not having to go through all the changes that puberty brings, like in a gender that they don't actually identify with. So fast forward then to 2011, in terms of this history of these puberty blockers, and this approach was also trialled in the UK in the gender services for kids there. What we know now is that preliminary results from this study in 2015 and 2016 didn't demonstrate a benefit to this approach. Those results weren't published until 2020, but nevertheless, from 2014 onwards, puberty blockers were available in routine clinical practice in the UK, and they were given to a broader group of patients than would have met the inclusion criteria for that original Dutch research. This is all set out in the CAS review. So in terms of the numbers of kids who were prescribed them, Cass actually couldn't get exact numbers. She expressed really serious concern about that. But she did request an audit so she could get more detail. So in this 4-year period of the audit, 2018 to 2022, about 3,300 patients were covered in that audit. And 27% of them were referred to endocrinology services. So they'd presented to the gender service, they'd gone on to be referred to endocrinology. Endocrinology is the medicine of hormones. And then of those, 75% went on to be prescribed puberty blockers, and in many cases also cross-sex hormones. So that's around 660 kids in that 4-year period.
Valerie, what effects does taking puberty blockers have then in real terms?
So there's been a lot of claims made for and against puberty blockers. One thing we probably can say with certainty now from the scientific literature, and this comes through in the CAS review, is that they can negatively affect people's bone density. It's not clear yet whether that can recover in adulthood. The science isn't there yet on that. The rationales for puberty blockers that I outlined there don't really seem to stand up to scrutiny based on the evidence we now have. And CAS also pointed to some serious potential risks that are not yet fully understood, including in relation to cognitive development in kids. Puberty is a really complex time. So she commissioned a big review of the evidence on puberty blockers from researchers at the University of York to inform her review. And in terms of those rationales, it didn't find changes in body satisfaction as a result of taking blockers could be demonstrated. It also found insufficient or at best kind of inconsistent evidence on the impact of puberty blockers on psychological well-being in these kids. The review also found that big majority of the young people who started on puberty blockers on the NHS went on to take masculinizing or feminizing hormones. So like what Cass kind of concluded from that was there was no evidence that puberty blockers were achieving that kind of initial stated aim of buying kids this time to think, time to explore. And she also suggested that puberty blockers don't offer that much benefit to trans men in terms of passing in later life because testosterone is really effective in masculinizing appearance. But she did say that there would be benefits in terms of passing for trans women if that was important to them to having taken puberty blockers.
And then what was Tavistock and the Gender Identity Development Service?
These were services in the UK for kids with gender discongruence or gender dysphoria. The Gender Identity Development Service, or GIDS, as it's known for short, started in 1989 and it operated out of buildings owned by the Tavistock and Portman Healthcare Trust in London. So it was often kind of known interchangeably as the Tavistock, although it did also have some satellite clinics elsewhere in the UK. So for most of that time, from 1989 onwards, it was primarily providing psychosocial and psychotherapeutic care to its patients, a really small number of patients every year. But then as we've seen, that changed, and then there was increased medicalisation, particularly in the form of hormone drugs. And that became part of what the service offered around the same time that the number of kids presenting began to really increase exponentially. And, you know, indeed, the CAS review was kind of commissioned by the NHS because an internal NHS review had found the evidence on these medical interventions was weak. The NHS decided to close GIDS down in 2022 on foot of the interim report of the CAS review, which found that having this kind of single centralised care centre wasn't sustainable. That review showed how the long waiting lists meant children weren't receiving timely care. Basically, like, GIDS was kind of operating way beyond its capacity, and that was leading to problems. That interim report also found that, you know, this specialised service had developed in quite an ad hoc way in response to this hugely increasing demand, because from 2009 and particularly from 2014, there was a huge increase in the number of kids presenting, particularly kids with a female birth sex who were now transitioning. And that kind of meant the clinical approach taken as it developed in response to this demand, like, it was ad hoc. It wasn't subject to the kind of normal quality controls when new and innovative treatments are being introduced. The service is also really struggling with high staff turnover. And the service, after that decision in 2022 to close, it did finally close last month. And the NHS is developing regional services now to replace it, two of which are opening. And, you know, over the course of the 35-year history of GIDS, then kind of summarised, it treated around 9,000 kids. And from 2012, we know that about 230 Irish kids were referred through the Tavistock.
Can you paint us a picture of life for a child then, or a young adult who might be referred to a clinic like this? Like, what is the level of distress that the clinicians might be facing?
We'd have to say first that, like, not all children and young people who are exploring their gender identity need clinical support, but some can experience really extreme distress, and that can get a lot worse in puberty. And of course, that has been compounded in the UK and in Ireland by these really long waiting lists for care. And Cass did note that, like, a group of children and young people at the Centre for a Report were frequently, not always, but they were frequently in considerable distress by the time they presented to the NHS, and, like, often with several unmet needs.
So what were the first concerns then to come on the radar about this clinic?
So concerns began to emerge kind of in the public domain in 2018. That's when it emerged that the service was conducting an internal review, and that was on foot of a report submitted to the Tavistock Trust's board by a senior member of staff at the Trust. And that member of staff was raising concerns about kids to the effect that the possible psychological and social reasons behind kids' kind of desire to transition weren't maybe being examined enough in the way that they should have been before the service then helped them to transition. Also that year, a group of parents of children who were being treated at service wrote to the board. They said they kind of feared their children were being fast-tracked to treatment, again, without enough assessment. And, like, probably in response to this huge increase in numbers seeking treatment, and that was putting massive pressure on the service. So that whistleblower, we later learned, was a consultant psychiatrist at the Tavistock Trust. His name is David Bell. And he has said that he was acting on the concerns, very serious concerns, of about 10 members of staff. So about a third of the staff at the clinic at the time, including that some children were recommended for treatment after just two appointments, and that too many maybe inexperienced psychologists were employed. A whole litany of really serious concerns, including in relation to the way puberty blockers were being prescribed. And then in 2019, as we've already discussed, there were concerns within NHS England about the lack of evidence underpinning some of the medical treatments that were being prescribed. And so in 2020, then the CAST review was commissioned.
And can we be clear here then, Valerie, that the treatment options then at Tavistock were valid, but it was how the clinic was treating the children involved that became the issue?
Yeah, like, to an extent, like, it seems to be the case that medical intervention is a positive for some children with gender dysphoria. That's unquestionable. But there just wasn't an evidence base for using puberty blockers as kind of routinely as they seem to have been used maybe at the Tavistock. And it is clear that the way the original Dutch research proposed this intervention should take place, like, the puberty blockers should be prescribed to children who were dysphoric from very early childhood and who were psychologically stable. And at this time, as we discussed, for children when they were on puberty blockers should be used to provide additional therapy to help them explore their gender, and that could improve children's well-being. That wasn't how they were being prescribed for some kids in the UK.
So this is where the CAST review comes into this. What is it?
So it was commissioned by the NHS, and for the reasons we've outlined there, and it was asked to make recommendations to the NHS. The chair, Dr. Hilary Cass, is a former president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. She's not someone who has worked in gender care. That seems to have been kind of a deliberate choice in her appointment. She didn't have skin in the game, so to speak. She was given really quite a wide term of reference to examine all aspects of the service. And she seems to have kind of consulted very widely in the course of her work. You know, she has said that she's spoken to many people about their lived experience, including transgender adults living positive and successful lives who feel really empowered by having made the decision to transition. She's also spoken to people who have detransitioned and who regret their earlier decisions. She spoke to parents of kids with really different perspectives, like some who have been so frustrated by being unable to get their kids onto a medical pathway that they really think their kids need. Others who feel the medical pathway was completely wrong for their kids, and that, you know, other factors in the kids' life, such as grief, neurodiversity, bullying, that they had been maybe ignored by the people who were giving them their care. And then, of course, she spoke to many clinicians, many academics. But again, with this huge array of perspectives coming forward, like, some of them believe that most children presenting at paediatric gender clinics will go on to have long-term trans identities. Some of them think kids are being wrongly medicalised when, you know, other difficulties in their lives could be sort of manifesting as gender distress.
Now, the report made some very pointed criticisms of the tone of the debate and how children are being used as a political football. What was said?
Oh, yeah. So, like, Dr. Cass has said that the toxicity of the debate was really exceptional. And she kind of said, like, in terms of healthcare, like, there's few other areas of healthcare where professionals are so afraid to kind of openly discuss their views, where there's so much vilification, so much bullying on social media, of course. She said there was, like, you know, remarkably weak evidence in this area, but that hasn't stopped kind of all sides in this so-called debate from kind of exaggerating or misrepresenting the results of the studies that there are to support their own viewpoints. And that really matters, you know, for kids and for healthcare, because, like, that polarisation and that stifling of debate is not doing anything to help the young people who are caught in the middle. And it could actually be hampering the research that, you know, the CASA view shows so strongly is really needed to help children and to kind of support them to thrive.
And you mentioned the research that she outlined, or the lack of it. What are the research gaps? What do we not know about care and outcomes for kids receiving gender treatment?
Well, we've already discussed, you know, how the CASA view's review of the scientific literature found pretty weak evidence on puberty blockers. That research team also examined the outcomes for older kids who take masculinizing or feminizing hormones. They found a lack of high quality research there, and that meant that no conclusions could be drawn about the effects of this treatment in a range of areas, including, you know, dysphoria and body satisfaction. But there was some suggestive evidence that psychological health could be improved. There has been a suggestion that hormone treatment can reduce the higher risk of death by suicide among trans people, but this scientific review also couldn't really find evidence to support that conclusion. There was a big lack of long-term follow-up studies. So that means we don't know how many people with hormones, for example, subsequently detransition. But Cass said there is a suggestion that the numbers here are increasing. And she said, like, that, you know, consideration kind of needs to be given now to how care for people who want to detransition is given. She suggested actually that a new service in that area may be warranted in the UK, I suppose, because people may not want to go back for care to the place where they transitioned in the first place. So there's huge problems in relation to the lack of research. And it's also a problem that there hasn't been proper research done on the longer term outcomes for trans kids who don't go down the route of hormonal intervention. This all really matters for those kids, for their families, because, you know, they're being asked to make decisions about their treatment kind of in the dark. So their doctors can't paint for them like a picture of the potential impacts, the potential outcomes, long-term risks, long-term benefits of the different options because of this lack of solid research. And one thing that really comes out of the CASA review is that a full programme of research is needed in this area. And the NHS has committed to that, and there have already been calls for Ireland to participate in that.
And then what is the model of care that was recommended by the CAST review? Is it something that is welcomed by trans people and doctors in this area?
The review really came down in favour of treating each patient as an individual. That was something that came through also from the young people who were spoken to for the review. That's what they want. So CAST said some children and some young people may benefit from medical intervention. Some may not. The clinical approach has to reflect that. And she emphasised that that takes time. And from everything that we now know about how the gender identity service and the Tavistock were operating, maybe some individual children's treatment wasn't getting the time it needed and deserved, just apparently because there was so much pressure on the service, as the number of children presenting with gender dysphoria exponentially increased. And that's likely to be one of the factors in how some of those problems arose. CAS made several recommendations aimed at ensuring that kids presenting to gender services would get the same standards of care that they could expect elsewhere in the NHS, including that the assessment process with children should be like holistic, should lead to an individualised care plan. It should include screening for neurodevelopmental conditions, including autism. It should include mental health assessment. She said most young people presenting to gender services, for most of them, a medical pathway is probably not going to be the best way to help them thrive. But for those for whom a medical pathway is clinically the correct course of action, it has to be provided along with accompanying wider mental health and psychosocial. She gave the example of, like, family breakdown and bullying, for example. It's likely that the CAST review's recommendations, if implemented, would mean much, much less use of hormonal treatment in kids under the age of 18. She recommended an extremely cautious clinical approach to using masculinizing and feminizing hormones for kids from the age of 16 on, in particular to allow the time to manage any other conditions the kids might have, to build up their resilience, and of course to allow for fertility preservation. In terms of the response to her recommendations, it is notable that the report has been publicly welcomed by some doctors working in Ireland's Adult National Gender Service, who take over the care of kids when they turn 18. And who have long argued for the importance of that kind of detailed holistic assessment that CAST proposes.
And were there criticisms then of the report and how it could impact young people maybe struggling with or at least questioning their gender?
The main trans advocacy groups in the UK and Ireland kind of cautiously welcomed the report and the fact that young trans people's voices seem to have been heard and respected. But they nearly all said they're going to study it and they're going to issue more detailed responses when they have done so. Most agreed with CASA's findings that young trans people were being failed by the current system. Mermaids, which is one of the UK's trans advocacy groups for young people, noted a 6-year waitlist now for treatment in the UK. Here in Ireland, TENI, the Trans Equality Network, did suggest the report was too sceptical about puberty blockers. It said that there was evidence that these had the potential to offer positive health outcomes, but again, they're planning to come back with a full analysis of the CASA report. In terms of other criticisms, CASA acknowledges herself in the report that some gender service users and some trans advocates see exploring other conditions and other diagnoses, such as through assessing for autism or mental health assessments, as an attempt to sort of find any other reason for the person's distress, you know, other than the fact that they are trans. That's the debate that we have seen play out in Ireland too, in terms of like how affirming our national gender service should be and like whether, for example, people who present should be required to be assessed by a psychiatrist. And that's part of kind of a wider debate about the extent to which being trans should be pathologised, because this can be stigmatising. And that was something that TENI has alluded to also in its response to the CASA report. But like ultimately, everybody in this conversation just wants the best for trans kids and wants them to get respectful care that meets all their needs. But as the dust settles on the CASA report and people have time to analyse the findings, which are really extensive, it is likely that there'll be differences in opinion on what that care should look like.
Now, we've touched on Ireland just briefly, but what about Ireland? How are gender issues treated here, firstly?
Gender care in Ireland is very, very limited at the moment. There's no specialist psychiatry and psychology service to assess and treat kids with gender dysphoria. At the moment, kids are referred abroad. The HSE told us for this podcast that kids will soon be directly referred to the new NHS regional gender services that are replacing the Tavistock. The HSE said that kids who go on to need endocrinology specialist care can receive that within the Children's Hospital Services here. But TENI told us that as far as they know, Children's Health Ireland isn't treating trans young people at the moment because of that lack of a psychiatrist with gender expertise to make assessments and referrals. So that's the situation in the public health system. The CAST review did highlight the fact that many families struggling to access services turn to private healthcare. She highlighted some concerns around that, and that's likely the case in Ireland too.
And finally, Valerie, how will the CAST review have an impact then in Ireland if you say that we're relying on our UK partners to address this issue?
So in terms of Ireland and the CAST review, the HSE has already conducted an internal review of the implications of the CAST report for gender services here. And that was finalised and published last year and took as its jumping off point the interim findings of the CAST review. It was fairly cursory, like in as far as the patient records of the kids who have been treated for gender over the past decade, which is less than 300, weren't reviewed. The review spoke to one parent of a child who had gone to Tavistock with the consent of that child, just one. But anyway, despite not digging very deeply, the review did paint a fairly bleak picture of service provision for gender questioning Irish kids. It found a service that was too slow to develop. It was putting kids who need care at risk. It was a service that was fragmented and that had deteriorated since the pandemic. It said there was a paediatric endocrinologist at Crumlin's Children's Hospital, but that service had been unable to accept referrals for a year at the time of the report because it was at capacity. And as we've already discussed, there's no child and adolescent mental health transgender service in Ireland. And this HSE review indicated there were big problems trying to recruit for that post. Problems with recruitment have also been a feature in the UK. So in the absence of a local specialist service in Ireland, children and young people who needed assessments were being referred to the UK. At the time of that HSE report last year, there were 72 Irish kids among 5,000 on the Tavistock waiting list. And a very small number of kids had actually been seen in other European countries, namely Belgium and Germany. There is, of course, a national gender service based at Loughlinstown Hospital in South Dublin, but it only works directly with adults. And there's a big problem there too for young adults because there's no clear pathway for them to move to that adult transgender service. They just join what's already a really long waiting list for Loughlinstown, or else they stay with the paediatric team, and that's not ideal according to Children's Health Ireland. And in fact, that one family that was consulted for that HSE review, the child in question, was at the time of the review on a waiting list for an appointment with the adult health service, despite having been treated through the paediatric system for 10 years. And they had socially, legally, medically fully transitioned, but they just couldn't get access to the gender service at Loughlinstown. In terms of the outcomes for Irish kids that went through GIDS and that went through the Tavistock, the HSE's finding in its review in response to the interim CAST report made for a slightly better reading, albeit, as we said, the review was really very cursory, so we can't read too much into it. But it found there wasn't serious adverse incidents reported in relation to children or young people who had used the service. And the HSE suggested in this review that the Irish health system had sort of mitigated some of the risks that were highlighted in the CAS report. So, for example, whereas healthcare staff in the UK reported feeling under pressure to adopt a really affirmative approach to clinical assessments and to diagnosis, that is to say, like to be guided by the patient's own preferences, particularly in the context of patients having gone through, you know, a really long waiting period before they get to be seen and then wanting to proceed quickly to the medical treatment they feel they need. The HSC didn't find evidence that that kind of gender-affirming approach had influenced hormone therapy use in Ireland, or that hormonal treatment had been fast-tracked, despite the long waiting lists here too. But there have been a lot of complaints about the lack of access to services in Ireland. In terms of what else we know, there's probably around 10 kids here currently on puberty blockers.
And has the HSC responded to the CAS report?
Yeah, so the HSC has said it will be mindful of the CAS review as it develops paediatric gender services here. So you'd have to assume that will mean that the kind of really cautious approach to puberty blockers that CAS has advocated will be adopted here going forward. There's questions for the government over its stated position on the kind of gender service we should have in Ireland, because there's actually a line in the programme for government saying that it will implement health policies for trans people in line with the World Professional Association of Transgender Healthcare, that's also known as WPATH, and that's a set of guidelines that's quite affirmative in approach, as in it places a strong emphasis on patient self-declaration as the basis for treatment and argues in favour of social transition for kids, which is something that CAS was a bit more cautious about. It's also quite positive about medical treatments, including hormones and surgery. And the CAS review was really critical of this WPATH report that's referred to in the programme for government. It criticises a lack of rigour in the development of the guideline. And for example, it says that the most recent iteration of the guideline in 2022 overstates the evidence for some of its recommendations. WPATH supported its findings that puberty blockers have psychological and psychosocial benefits by relying on what the CAS review has now found were low quality studies. But, you know, kind of to conclude, like it's just really clear that Ireland has just been too slow to develop the services needed by children with gender dysphoria. And I think the publication of the CAS review's final report has really shone a spotlight on that fact again. And we'll see now in the coming weeks and months and years whether the HSC can actually implement the kind of like holistic, accessible public service that many people, including CAS, are saying the kids really need and deserve.
And I think really it's clear the issue needs so much more examination and calm, informed debate, doesn't it? And I think we should remember that at the heart of this issue are young children who are very much in need of support. Valerie, thank you so much for joining us today and outlining all of the facts around this. Thanks again to Valerie Flynn for joining us today. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode, you can contact the Samaritans by calling 116 123 or email joe@samaritans.ie. That's joe@samaritans.ie. You've been listening to the Explainer podcast by thejournal.ie. This episode was brought to you by senior producer Nikki Ryan and executive producer Sinead O'Carroll. If you'd like to support all the work we do here, head to thejournal.ie/contribute to make a one-off donation or become a monthly subscriber. And of course, you can always leave a review and a rating wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.